So comparative theology, as a discipline, as I'll mention a bit down the page, it's had a somewhat long history. There's been 19th century, 20th century uses of the word comparative together with theology. Certainly theology is a very well-used word in the Christian tradition, to some extent in other traditions. We also know that the word comparative study of religion, comparative history, I mean, all kinds of comparative entries have gone on. Part of what we're trying to talk about here is how to do what is recognizable as theology, both in terms of its religious context, in terms of different traditions, and also as an academic discipline, the kind of crossing the boundary between theology as something that believers do inside their own community, whatever that community is, and then comparative theology as something that also can be pursued in an academic fashion in university. As we'll see, and as you may anticipate, comparative work is always problematic, and there are all kinds of minefields and pitfalls and so on that one can end up having trouble with. And I think comparative theology is not going to be any easier in a way, but we can nevertheless see how things go. The first thing I thought I'd do, number one there, is what is theology? And I think the way I think, I'm a Roman Catholic, and follow basic kind of standard Roman Catholic views of theology, which right back to Augustine and Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages, believe that theology is a question of faith, but it's faith with a very strong intellectual rational component. That there's a point where the world of belief is not simply kind of insulated and invulnerable to critique or thinking, but that there's a genuine way in which, as Aquinas would put it, theology is one of the sciences. And although, you know, in the 13th century Aquinas wasn't thinking of sciences the way we think of sciences today, he certainly was thinking of kind of propositional truths, arguable theses, positions that are accessible even to people who don't share the belief. They can at least understand what you're talking about and so on. And one of the standard definitions that goes back at least to Augustine and probably before is faith seeking understanding. And there's a tension there, because there are many ways to seek understanding and there are many ways to have faith. But the discipline of theology is when the two come together, with faith and understanding as kind of meeting each other and connecting with one another. And it's a process, of course, that in any kind of theology is a tension, because sometimes understanding can upset your faith. Understanding can undermine things that people just believe because they were given them by their tradition or whatever. And likewise, faith can sometimes put boundaries on understanding and say, well, certain questions cannot be asked because we're believers. And I think when it's done well, there's a healthy tension so that faith is constantly worrying about where the understanding is going, and understanding is raising all the uncomfortable questions that believers often don't want to deal with, and back and forth. In conversation and cooperation with area studies, study of religion, other areas of theology, including the theology of religions. And this for me is very important, because I think we can sort of get into a dichotomy of some sort, that one is either a theologian or an Indologist or a Sinologist or an Islamicist. One takes a choice between them, or one is either doing history of religions or one is doing theology. It seems to me that, at least from my viewpoint, in terms of understanding how theology works, these disciplines need one another, and that theology is much better off, for instance, if it is cognizant of modern science or cognizant of philological studies, or takes history seriously. And I think, too, there are questions that come up in Indology or Oriental studies or comparative work in general that aren't really completely dealt with in terms of those disciplines. So questions of moral application, questions of the truth of what is said, questions of mystical experience and the way they're mediated through textual traditions. But the main thing I'd like to say is that I think a better, particularly if somebody's trying to do comparative work, a theologian is better off if the theologian takes seriously learning languages, doing cultural studies, knowing the questions of history, talking to sociologists of religions, and opening up a wider range of possibilities. and that theologians who kind of isolate themselves and say, because I'm a theologian, I don't need to do those things. I think he's a bad theologian as well as probably making a fool of himself when he starts talking about different religions. When I mentioned theology of religions, that may or may not be familiar to you, whether depending on the background. But at least in the Christian tradition, but I think in other traditions as well today, and in history, there's a good deal of speculation about what to make of other religious traditions. This is a big issue in Christian theology. I can give you the bibliography if you want. But a sense that there is Christians have tended for many years to worry about, well, what should Christians think about Hindu or Buddhist traditions? What should Christians think about Islam? How should Christians think about the dynamic between being open to other religions and trying to convert people to the Christian religion? And there's a whole field in which Christian theologians write about Christ and world religions. It's a big thing in many areas. But even there, I would think that that kind of theologizing about religions is usually poorly done, because the theologians don't actually know anything about other religions. They speculate based on kind of generic Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam or Judaism or whatever. And I think one reason why these things go together is that if you do some kind of textual work in a tradition other than your own, if you pay attention to history, if you study how historians of religion work and all that, it changes the way you think about how what even religion means or traditions mean, and therefore you have a kind of opening to a different kind of understanding back and forth. I would think number three there, comparative theology fits into other kinds of theology. And again, Keith Ward is supposed to be sitting here, so some of these comments are directed to him. You can send them the tape for that. In the context of ecclesial theology, I think there are parallels in other traditions, but again, I'm starting with the Christian tradition, that there are many different aspects to theology. There's the study of scripture, there is ethics, there is like reflection on the liturgical or ritual practice of Christians, there is meditations on the meaning of Christ, the meaning of the nature of God, and so on. There are all these kinds of things, and not all of them are comparative. Some of them are specifically based on the Bible. And I can imagine in other traditions, you know, a way of reflection on faith entirely rooted in reading the Quran, or entirely rooted in reading certain Buddhist sutras, or reading the Upanishads. And that there are ways in which not all theologians should be comparativists, and not all comparativists should be theologians either. There's a limit to how much of this should be done. And I certainly feel that the labor can be divided up, but just as I won't do what a sociologist or an anthropologist of religion does, I'm also not doing what most professors of church history do, or Christology, or Vedic studies do. And I think there's a kind of cooperation back and forth across these boundaries. And one sort of assumes that these disciplines should work together. I think generally speaking, you have to be a comparative theologian within a tradition, because theologians work within traditions. So we can talk later about whether there's such a thing as a Buddhist theologian or a Hindu theologian or a Muslim theologian, because theology is an English word in the Christian tradition. But I think to some extent this kind of faith-seeking understanding starts in a tradition and then branches out. And when I talk to people, I spend all my time reading Hindu texts and studying Sanskrit and Tamil literature and so on. But I describe myself as a Christian theologian, because that's where I start, and that's where I end up, I think. We can talk about what difference that makes in terms of boundaries. But I think one starts that way. But I think on this number four, under the first part there, whether or not comparative theology ends up being something that doesn't fit in with traditions. I mean, I'm aware, you know, sometimes if you go deeply enough into the study of multiple religious traditions, if you develop a really complex comparative vocabulary and so on, the people of your own background and own tradition may no longer know what you're talking about. And they may begin to say, well, you know, it doesn't sound like what we mean by faith-seeking understanding, or it doesn't sound like thinking within our tradition. You know, you spend too much of your time reading that instead of reading this. Or are you worried about that ritual practice rather than our ritual practice? And I think to some extent it may be, and I'll come back to this below, kind of a possibility that if enough people do enough comparative work and talk to enough people in other religious traditions, you end up with kind of a community that cuts across the boundaries. And you have people who are comparativists to the extent that when they think of their own tradition, they're always thinking of other traditions, and the questions they pose kind of go back and forth. But I think basically still most people who would bother calling themselves theologians start somewhere in some particular tradition. Under number two, the Roman numeral two, comparative theology as a discipline with historical roots, we read all of that, to point out again that I think comparative work has always been done. Some people argue that, you know, we learn by comparing anything. We learn how to walk down the street by seeing how other people walk down the street. We learn to speak our native tongue by learning with other people. We compare ourselves athletically or artistically with other people and so on. We do comparisons and contrasts all the time. And I think there is a way in which either because of being very professional in terms of one's area of study of religion or study of an area of the world or something, or very kind of focused in terms of one's religious tradition and background, one can sort of say that maybe comparative work can't be done, or it's too sloppy, or it's better off if we don't do it, and people just stay either in their discipline or in their religious community and just stay there. But I think these things that I just tick off here under Roman numeral 2 are just examples, and you can think of others, in which probably right, you know, for thousands of years, anyone who's thought about religious practice, worship, mystical experience, life and death issues, and so on, has been doing comparative work. Comparing insiders' views with outsiders' views. Even if it's sometimes put very polemically, the main thing I need to know about what you believe is that you're wrong and I'm right. Or your view is somehow an inferior version of my view, or whatever. Even if it's that way, which it need not be, there's still a sense, I think, in which people compare and contrast their own views with those of others. And these are pretty obvious, and I won't spend time on them unless you want to come back to them. But certainly the Christian tradition, being a Christian, was a comparative enterprise right from the start. You can't be a Christian without being Jewish in some sense. There's no way to kind of separate off a Christian identity that is purely not Jewish or Gentile. And likewise, you know, very early on, beginning with the Greek of the New Testament, the Christian consciousness was tied in with the Greco-Roman world. And the Greco-Roman world was a much larger world. It was a literature, philosophy, religious practices, mythologies, social structures and all that, that eventually kind of intermeshed with Christian doctrine, Christian practice. Constantine made Christianity the religion of the empire. But I think you'd have to see the first three or four centuries of Christian tradition as basically a comparative exercise, among other things, in which being Christian was sort of sorting out being Jewish, being Greco-Roman, and somehow defining a Christian identity in relation to those others. Likewise, Islam was kind of what I put there as pagan, but I'm thinking kind of indigenous Arabic, Arab peninsula traditions and beliefs. Some knowledge, and we see this very clearly in the Quran, some reflection on Jewish and Christian sources in early Islam. Some religious practices from Christianity working their way into early Islam and so on. That even though Islam would tend, I would think that I'm not an Islamicist, but many times one would think of Islam as a very pure, separable tradition, but that there are all these kind of dynamics and elements of exchange with other traditions as part of it. Medieval Christian theology and dialogue with Judaism and Islam. David Burrell is a theologian at University of Notre Dame in the States. And he by tradition and by background, is a philosopher of religion and scholar in the work of Thomas Aquinas. But about 15 years ago, Burrell started asking, who did Aquinas talk to? And although Aquinas is living in the 13th century, and you sort of think of that as the heart of Christendom, Burrell points out that, and this is obvious when you start reading Aquinas' works, in kind of an active dialogue with Jewish and Muslim thinkers, particularly Maimonides among Jewish thinkers, and then Ibn Sina and several others on the Muslim side. And they may have been dead for several centuries, some of them, but he was reading their work in translation and trying to work out kind of an idea of God that made sense in terms of Jewish and Muslim and Christian instincts. And Burrell's two books, I should have put the names here, I think one is called Knowing the Unknowable God. Knowing the Unknowable God. And the other one, I think, is Creation and Freedom. He may have done more sense, but those are two books in which he has this kind of triangular relationship, showing that even Thomas Aquinas, that kind of ultimate Catholic theologian, is a comparativist. I'll do this more briefly because I think you get the point. In the Indian context, under 4 and 5, both the Brahmanical traditions in their Sanskritic, what came to be called Hindu form, but also the Buddhist traditions, in relationship to older indigenous groups, Sanskritic languages in relationship to non-Indo-European languages and so on, practices that probably were not originally Indo-European, working their way into traditions and so on. I think most people would see that in the Indian context there's so much exchange among religious traditions that part of one's identity as Vaishnava or Shaiva or a certain form of Buddhist, whatever, is in exchange with others. And there's a kind of sense of the consciousness shared among the different positions. 6-7 bring up kind of later developments that have to do more with the academic world. And I think this would be interesting to talk about in terms of where we end up in the 19th and 20th centuries. So what do we do at a university? And where do we come up with categories like theology as an academic discipline, the study of religion, the social sciences, philosophy as not being theology, and then in the States at least, the science of religion, history of religions, comparative religion, all these different disciplines. How do these things interconnect with one another? One could do, and certainly people have been working on, kind of a history of the kind of post-medieval imperial European period, the colonialist period, the Enlightenment, kind of invention of the study of religion and indeed, in a sense, the invention of religions. The missionaries, I've done some work on the Jesuit missionaries around the world, some of the first missionaries in the Catholic tradition to study other traditions very seriously in the 17th, 18th, 16th even centuries. But their kind of reports and kind of coming to terms with the beliefs and practices of other people around the world, both in very highly sophisticated, literate cultures like China, Japan, India, but also Native Americans in North and South America and so on. A lot of that going into kind of formulating ideas such as religion, such as culture, such as society. And then the study of religions as an Enlightenment phenomenon and the, in a sense, invention of religion and religions figure in here, and I think these are kind of explicitly comparative and have been done for centuries, and I think, you know, we are simply continuing a tradition. The term comparative theology is actually a term that's been used on and off for at least two centuries. I mentioned that David Tracy has an article in the Encyclopedia of Religion. I think it's there, if you go to, it's the big Encyclopedia of Religion, it's like 12 volumes, and in the volume on theology, or in the volume where T is, theology, there's one on, I think, systematic theology and then comparative theology. But Tracy points out the 19th century uses of the term, sometimes done by people who have no real interest in other religious traditions, but wanted to line up Christian doctrines in relationship to other doctrines to sort out similarities and differences. The term, I know, currently at Boston University, down the block from where I usually teach, in the 19th century, there was a kind of move to do comparative theology. And it was, again, I think something like what I'm talking about, realizing that comparison is inevitable, that there are many religions around, and then trying to do it in a way that fits in with theological traditions and doing comparative work theologically. One could do a lot of that, and I'm not at the moment thinking you need to do it, but to realize that the term was not invented just recently. It's an old term of comparative theology. But distinctive features under Roman numeral 3 there, why now in the 21st century doing the study of religion, being a believer, seeking to understand one's own and other religious traditions, is almost essentially a comparative enterprise. I mean, I try not to be a fascist about this, and I really don't believe that everyone should do the work that I'm doing, because I think that would make a fool of yourself if you try to say that to people. But I do think, for the most part, most people get involved in some kind of comparative work if they're serious about studying religions from inside or outside, or theologizing in one's own tradition or across boundaries. For one thing, pluralism is greater than ever. It has always been pluralism, but I think it's higher in people's consciousness now than it's ever been before. And I think even in fairly conservative enclaves of Christian thinking, such as might happen here somewhere at the university, it's inescapable that there are other religions and other ways of thinking out there. And you walk down the street and you see people from different religions, and you look into your own heart and you find different religious impulses that may not fit into your own tradition. So I think it's just everything is much more accentuated now than it has been in the past. Number two, I really should have phrased differently. Increasingly articulate academic and theological voices in other religious traditions. What I really meant to say was in religious traditions other than the Western Christian. Because I think for a long time, related to Orientalism, related to kind of Western imperialism, the mode was very much that Westerners do the thinking about what other people sort of believe and do. But that the real kind of self-conscious, reflective thinking is a European thing, a philosophical thing, a Christian thing. And I think part of the dawning awareness that should have dawned a while ago, but is hitting most people's consciousness now, is that there are articulate, complex, sophisticated oral and written traditions everywhere in the world, and that you have very kind of sophisticated people speaking about and for their traditions into this situation of pluralism. And it's no longer a world in which somebody can say, all right, you go out and do the things you do and we'll observe you and write about you. But that there's kind of an interactive model in which, like what I mentioned above about the theology of religions, I think it's becoming increasingly undesirable or unfeasible for a Christian to imagine that he or she can write a book about other people's religions without entering into dialogue with those people. And I think that's just the way of the future. Postmodern subjective and hermeneutical awareness. I think we're also much more sensitive today, and agree with it or not, but I think it's probably true, that you can't study something without being involved in it. Objectivity is very important, and there are definitely ways in which we can do more rather than less objective. And, you know, you can read an Upanishad, or you can read a biblical text, or you can read parts of the Quran with a certain amount of objectivity, just trying to get at what the text says. But I think we're aware now that to do that in 100% fashion, where you're sort of a neutral observer simply describing what's there, is almost impossible. And there are all kinds of subjective factors involved. There are all kinds of issues of purpose, of power, of what's acceptable in the academic world that one lives in, and so on, such that there are all kinds of interferences along the way. And it would be very naive for any scholar today to say, I'm simply getting the facts. I'm simply doing it without any interest in meaning or any subjective involvement. But everything is kind of interactive. And therefore that to be studying a religion, whether one's own or another, is to be engaging in some kind of reflective back and forth practice. And that when I, as a Christian, when I read Vedic texts or Tamil Vaishnava texts or whatever, I have to be aware that I'm bringing all kinds of Christian presuppositions to the work. Or if I'm brought up in a secular background and don't have any religious tradition, I'm bringing that to my reading of texts. And I'm avoiding certain questions because I've not been comfortable with them my whole life long. And so on. So I think this kind of sense that everybody is always involved, everybody is entangled, a kind of postmodern sense of complexity is where we need to think of ourselves today. Ford is basically the same thing, basically saying that in a faith context, this is a good thing. To highlight and admit that you start maybe in your own tradition, so it's just be hypothetical, a Buddhist reading Muslim texts, Islamic texts, I don't know how often that happens, but let's talk about that. That the Buddhist brings certain Buddhist presuppositions and concerns to reading the Quran, or various hadith and so on, and doesn't read the Quran the way a Muslim would. then if the Buddhist is serious enough about reading these texts, then he or she ends up reading Buddhist suttas differently because of having some knowledge of the Quran. And I think the entanglement and the way that one, you know, encumbers the other tradition with one's own faith, and then on the basis of what one learned, one complicates one's own faith back in one's home tradition, is actually a good thing. Some people don't like to do it. Some people like to keep a boundary, and I can respect that. But I think for the most part, it's a creative intellectual process that is worthwhile to go back and forth and to see these complexities. Number five and number six really go together. That I think for a long time, maybe as the product of the Enlightenment in the West, but you could point to certain logical traditions in India and so on, a desire to get everything neat and straight and come to conclusions. And a comparative process is often considered undesirable because it doesn't lead to a proposition. It doesn't lead to a claim and say, therefore, we have learned the following. And I know personally, sometimes my own work, or you've been studying Indian texts for so many years, what exactly is it that you learn that we don't already know? You know, and a philologist, an Indologist may ask me that, and a Christian theologian may ask me that. What is it you've learned that you don't already know? I think a lot of times it's very hard to pin down, and there's a certain way in which it's a much more complicated praxis in which one has learned to think differently, one makes different kinds of connections, and you really have to tell somebody you're not going to get this unless you actually do some of it. And that it's not sort of neatly packageable and you say, all right, I've done this, and this is the result, and you can have the result even though you didn't do the practice. But that the, you know, within one's own field, one's own profession, one's own discipline, but then also when one steps out to the other, some kind of engagement and involvement, it is a messy process, but I think also a necessary process. And that, I think, is a modern phenomenon, that certainly looking like back at the history of the Jesuit missionaries in India and China and so on, there was a great desire at a certain point to come to conclusions and to say the reason these people need to become Christian is the following. The main errors of Islam are this, this, and this. The problem with Hindu superstition is the following. And I think we're not, you know, and you can see Indian arguments, Buddhist-Hindu arguments, very strong polemic back and forth that would come to conclusions. I don't think we're very comfortable with such conclusions today. And I think that defines kind of the world in which we are. And I think number six there repeats number two, so I won't say anything about it. I'll finish this off briefly and then open it up for discussion. In the book I wrote, came out last year, called Hindu God, Christian God, How Reason Helps Break Down the Boundaries Among Religions. I've been doing, you know, comparative stuff for years, but in this book, which is really aimed at, most of the book is about India and about Hindu traditions, Brahmanical, Sanskritic traditions for the most part, some Tamil. It's really aimed at Christian theologians and trying to persuade Christian theologians to realize that if you just want to be a theologian, you should be a comparativist. Why? Because many of your most collegial theologians happen to belong to other religious traditions. It struck me that simply talking, in the context of doing it, and I'll pass it around so you can look if you haven't seen it, is that simply talking about comparative work is not enough, probably, because there's always a question of the context and what makes comparative work possible and where does it lead. And so in this book, in the first chapter, I spell out there under Roman numeral 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, interreligious, comparative, dialogical, and apologetic as kind of a fuller picture that might still be filled out beyond that, probably will. But that you can't do comparative work in a theological sense unless there is already some kind of an interreligious common ground and communicability. If religions really are kind of separable worlds and that you can never understand somebody else's religion at all, or if there's no possibility of communication back and forth, or no history of engagement and involvement back and forth, you can't suddenly say, well, there's nothing there, but I think I'll just start doing comparisons. And part of my argument is that right from the start, there are all these interconnections in history, in languages, in translations, when we all start talking in English to one another, we're doing an enormous, complex borrowing back and forth. There are probably elements in human nature about the fact that we have language, the fact that we think, the fact that we talk, the fact that we are born and die and have babies and so on. There are all these things in common that human beings have that are not simply, you know, this is mine and that's yours, but we're already kind of complicated interreligious people from the start, on the basis of which one can step back and do intelligent comparisons and contrasts. But then I also put in this chapter, the first chapter of that book, dialogical encountability, in the sense that, and I know I've often been tempted to this myself, is to try to neatly, you know, sit at my desk and do my work and write about them, and then publish it, you know, and then get book reviews and so on. Not get rich by writing books, but get book reviews at least, and conferences and so on. But I think that's not enough because, you know, unless you're writing about a religion that has truly died out and doesn't exist anymore, so, I don't know, Moabite religion or, you know, totally Aztec, I don't know, maybe there are Aztecs, but religions that are gone, for the most part, it makes much more sense that just as if you write a book in theology or in some branch of Indian studies or Chinese studies, whatever, you do expect reviews. You do expect people to read your book and like parts of it and not like parts of it and so on. I don't think you should have kind of a solitary conversation where you do some research and then you talk to people like yourself about them. But there has to be a back and forth across the boundaries. It's pretty obvious, I guess, but it's learned on me gradually. So that accountability in the sense of, I'm certainly not the first one to say this, people like Wilfred Campbell Smith have said it for years, that when you talk about other people's religious traditions and describe their theologies and so on, you're accountable to them. At least in the sense to start that there's some kind of recognizability to what you say about them to people in that tradition. You don't get to be normative and say, well, actually, your tradition is exactly what I say it is. And you also don't allow the other person to have normativity and say, well, I'm inside the tradition, so I know exactly what it is, and you don't. But at least some kind of back and forth, where, you know, if I portray things in a certain way, or if I choose certain texts and not others, to have some kind of intelligent reasons for that, that I can talk to somebody in the other tradition and make some sense of it. And then to give an account back when they criticize me back. And that's kind of further dialogue back and forth when questions are posed back and forth. Some of this actually does happen textually. If you read text carefully, they interrogate you. You know, if any of you doing textual work, translating or studying a certain tradition, whatever, just like people, the texts written by people are complicated. And the more you commit yourself to getting them right, the more they frustrate your plan to conquer them. You end up sort of being won over by the text because it draws you into its world. But either textually or with people, there has to be this conversation that goes on back and forth. I exemplify this in the book. Parimal Patil is a young professor at Emory University in Atlanta in the States, a recent PhD from the University of Chicago, who I talked to about this manuscript as I was working on this book. And finally, we agreed that he would write a postface or an epilogue to the book called Christian God, Hindu God, so turning the title around. And he has 10 pages in the back of it, sort of taking my proposition for kind of a comparative theology, interreligious theology, conversation across religious boundaries. What does it look like if you've grown up Hindu, as a Hindu scholar, a Hindu who is a scholar? And he agrees with it to a large extent. That's why I let him do it. But also says it's not so simple that, you know, theology, comparative work, the modern academy are all deeply intertwined with Christian history. You know, it's so clear a place like Oxford. It developed out of Christian roots and background. English language is deeply interconnected traditionally with the Christian way of posing the world and so on. Colonialism, imperialism, Orientalism have had their effect. And he basically argues that, yes, there can be this conversation back and forth, But people in places like India are going to have to work out their own ways of engaging it. And they're going to have to find other language systems, other ways of talking about things that don't simply say, all right, we'll all become Western academics and we'll do this thing together. And I think it's good. I'm glad he did it. I'm glad it's in the book so that people read what I wrote and people read kind of an immediate response to it. The thing about apologetics, which fits in with Roman numeral 5, critique and apologetics, some people I know dislike, some people like comparative work because it postpones any kind of conclusions. And you are a comparativist forever and you never say if anything's true or not. You simply study and you compare. And that can happen within disciplines too. So you can be an Indologist and never raise an issue of truth. Or you can be a theologian and never raise an issue of truth. You can just sort of study forever and ever. But I think, you know, for many people in religious traditions, back to the start, people who have faith, they have very strong views about what is true and what is right. And they want to know from their scholars and their theologians what is true and what is right. What do you think is true and what do you think is right? And I get this question in various ways myself, and probably some of you do in your own work. You know, is what we believe true? Is what they believe true? Is it right to act in this way? Is it right to act in that way? Is it possible to study another person's tradition and then criticize it? You know, and say, well, there are basic things about your tradition I actually disagree with. Or I think, you know, there's a great classic masterpiece of your tradition and I find it flawed in the following 5 ways. I think that's possible. You know, again, it's accountability. So you can always, they can say back to you, well, guess what? Your tradition is flawed in 6 ways. And, you know, we have problems with what you're talking about and you don't understand it, so on. Given all of that and given a sense of being humble enough to learn from others, I don't see any reason why comparative work precludes questions of truth. Or why, if you're a comparativist, you can't come to conclusions about what is true or not. That if insofar as the scholar can ever claim the truth or claim value, a comparativist can do it too. So somebody can read Thomas Aquinas all their lives long, and some will never have come to the point of saying, and everything Aquinas says is true, others will say it's true from day one. If I spend my life reading Shankara, or reading Ramanuja, or reading a Chinese text, conceivably I can come to the point of saying, well, yes, this is actually true, or it actually doesn't make any sense, it doesn't relate to reality properly. I also think that's very hard to do. In fact, I do very little of that. It's easier, like, to point to injustices and say, well, there's something wrong with the way you're acting. There's something wrong with your social structures. But that doesn't necessarily have an intrinsically religious aspect to it. It can be human beings screw up their lives, whatever religion they belong to, if possible. But at least I think the accountability can be there. All of this, I hope you're taking mental notes so we can, in a moment, talk about this. Number 6, I just point out a number of books, recent books that I would put in the category of comparative theology that you might want to look at. I already mentioned mine. John Carman, recently retired from Harvard, has this fascinating comparative study of paradox on polarity in religious traditions, starting with his own Christian background. He's born in India in a missionary family. His study of the Ramanuja Hindu tradition, but also then looking at Japanese Buddhism, certain teachers of Islam, certain Protestant, Orthodox, Roman Catholic traditions, other Hindu traditions, and so on, trying to argue that there are very few kind of conceptual identities among religions, but there are certain kinds of paradoxes and tensions that you can see repeated again and again and again in different religious traditions. It's a very ambitious book, but I think it comes out pretty well. My colleague at Boston College, John McCransky, is a Tibetan Buddhist scholar, an American who is Tibetan, who is a Buddhist in the Tibetan tradition. Roger Jackson is another professor. I think he's a Buddhist. But they said, all right, Buddhists don't believe in God, so Buddhists can't do theology in a literal sense. But theology is most like what we want to do in the 21st century in North America. Faith-seeking understanding, believers talking about their tradition. And they said, all right, making in the preface all the apologetic remarks for using Buddhist and theology together, said, we're going to have essays here on Buddhist theology. And basically what they try to do is say, Buddhism is in a new situation in 20th, 21st century America. All the different Buddhist traditions of Asia suddenly are jostling together. People are combining them in a very American way and so on. There's a new moment in Buddhist history. And somebody has to be thinking about what does this mean for Buddhist identity, and the essays in this book kind of contribute to that project. Michael Myers, who I don't know, wrote this interesting book recently called Brahman, a Comparative Theology, which I bought at great expense in Blackwell's, just so I could show it to you today. Which is an interesting book. I think he's not an Indologist, so he, you know, is using other people's work, which I think is fine. But he sort of deals with Vedantic traditions, but then branches off into ethics, branches off into mysticism and so on, trying to talk about what he has learned from India and then how it relates to basic Christian values and thoughts that he's had over the years. And it's a complicated book that I won't try to explain to you. But it, I think it's a good example of kind of the fact that it's become being more common. Theologians who don't have a specialist background in different religious traditions trying to do solid comparative work, and as he says at the beginning, I think it's trying to criticize and re-understand Christian theology in light of other different faiths. It's not as focused on Brahman as the title would lead, but it is, I think, an interesting effort to cross the boundaries. Keith Ward, who's not here, you all know his series of books, Religion and Revelation and Creation and Human Nature and Community. Keith, I think after his work on science and religion, also realized that this is a cutting-edge area of theology today, to do comparative work even if you're a Christian theologian. And I think in an admirable way, in each of these books, he tries to kind of set up in the first part of each book what Judaism, Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism say about revelation, creation, human nature, community. And then the second part, he kind of reflects on it as a Christian theologian. It's different from the way I would do comparative work, but I think it's very interesting and admirable project that he carried out quite impressively over four different volumes. And then finally, I just point to an interesting project that I'm involved with. Theological Studies is a major journal of Christian theology in the United States. About four times a year, etc. We have a thematic issue coming up in which I'm collaborating with a couple of Christian theologians, but also a rabbi, two Buddhist scholars, and an Islamicist, Pakistani background, who is a Muslim, about trying to talk about how other religious traditions, other than the Christian, have located and understood other religions together. So, what are Muslim views of the other, Jewish views of the other, Hindu views of the other, Buddhist views of the other, and what kinds of kind of categories and judgments have they made so to locate the other, connect it back to their own truth, make judgments, and so on. And then in this essay, issue, trying to say all of these other ways of theologizing about other people's religions should be of interest to and change the way Christian theologians think about other religions. Because sometimes Christians think we're the only people who've ever thought of these problems or questions. And it's quite clear from these developing essays that everybody thinks about it. People do it in different ways and worry about different things, but that it needs to be carried on more consciously as something we're all doing. So we'll skip over number 7 for obvious reasons and open it for questions, discussions. If we really get bored, I have another handout, but we don't need to get to it, because I'd be happiest just to, yeah, some of you have heard this before, but anybody would like to jump in with discussion?
The strange paradox in comparative work, the more you want to compare it, the more you, the more the problem poses itself of expertise. If you're following the objective approach which you described from the beginning, you just make generalization, but but in your case, whom do you talk to? I mean, is that something which you're aware from your aware of? You're aware of
having
practice of interreligious dialogue, comparative work?
Of having to talk to specialists, you mean? Or?
Well, no, I mean, you don't talk to anyone in Hinduism if you're doing the kind of work you're doing, I suppose.
Why?
But you have to. What are the authoritative voices in Hinduism which you have to dialogue with?
it tends to be
right, in Hinduism it's probably less problematic than in Islam, or
yeah, I think it, well, I mean, first of all, there's the question of I mean, there's several questions I would sort out there. One would be, who do academics talk to anyway? And usually academics talk to other academics. And there are an increasing number, like, of Hindu professors in the United States, and I suppose here too, who, you know, have academic positions and write in the same journals and so on. So it's getting easier to carry on such conversations. It used to be stereotypical that the Western scholar would go to India and talk to pundits and try and pundits and talk to them. But there's also the kind of question of elite knowledge, in the sense that I'm aware that many of the texts I spend my time reading, most Hindus on the street would not be reading anyway. And, you know, and there's a whole way of kind of living Hindu life and practicing it and being Indian that is not identical with getting the Sanskrit text off the shelf and studying the commentary. So, and often, you know, if I talk to ordinary educated Hindus, they won't have any idea what I'm reading, you know, and they say, well, there are these other things we should be talking about and so on. But I think it's a multi-level thing. It's just as, you know, a theologian often has a multiple identity. So the, you know, the professor in the university, the person who speaks with and for his or her religious tradition, like if somebody's a canon of Christ Church, they'll preach in the cathedral every now and then, do the evensong. Somebody, you know, may have students who also can be helped spiritually, pastorally. Somebody might get the idea to speak to a popular group in London or something about this or that. I think we often kind of function on multiple levels, and I think scholars in different traditions do. But I think one of the things, you know, is really important is to create the conditions for dialogue by facilitating more learning by more people and more traditions about their own tradition and other traditions, so that people can talk to each other more intelligently. Is that
okay? One thing is that it's difficult in doing comparative work and some others have the results of what this population has taken at the end of the country. You often just have to say, okay, go with me, do it with me, here's how you do it. Does that mean that it's pretty much an individual endeavor rather than something that can be shared? I mean, is it that the only way you can share with others is to bring as many people along, or can that labor sharing happen that you talked about, where you can do the work and someone else can do the management by reading what you write?
Yeah. I mean, like most of the things, the answer is sort of both. I mean, it's on the one level, I mean, it's like many of the most important things in life, you have to do them to appreciate them. You know, like I've never skied, I've never run a marathon. I expect you have to do these things to really get into them. I mean, you have to be involved in them, practice them. And I think certain kinds of intellectual discipline are not simply, you know, tricks or something like that, but it's a way of life, and you study these things, you get involved in them, you practice them. And a lot of times I've written things so as to try to invite students and professors to get involved and think this way, and to enter the thinking, which is both kind of a spiritual and intellectual discipline of getting involved. But I'm also aware that just as I treat religion and science discussions as, I'm not going to learn the science, I'm not going to do the math, and I'm not going to do that stuff, so, you know, I need some kind of summary or some kind of lead for somebody who's not going to do it, and so-and-so is not going to learn Sanskrit, and so-and-so is not going to learn Tibetan, and so-and-so is not going to learn Arabic. How do you kind of communicate something of the fruit of what you've been doing to people who aren't in a position to do all the work? Like the book, my book, it's aimed at Christian theologians. This time trying to say, you already have recognizable theological questions, and each chapter begins with a famous Christian theologian. If you understand those theologians at all you have to begin to do is realize that these theologians in other traditions are talking about many of the same questions, and you can actually share a conversation, hoping in a way that my book would give them something to theologize about. But it's difficult because, as I said, if you just have the results and say, you know, the conclusion is the following, So also, sometimes people want to know which one is better. You know, like, have you concluded that all religions are the same, or that? And often that's very difficult, and for all kinds of reasons. But I think to some extent you can do both. You should invite people in and then give them something to think about. Yes?
Richard King says in his latest book, something along, and it's Edward, and part of this Edward Said tradition of the difficulty of knowing the other. And he goes so far as to say that Hinduism is a Western construction. And part of his criticism is that the intellects came in and influenced the Brahmins, their intellectual tradition, and brought in all these Judeo-Christian stereotypes. Just raises questions. I guess he wouldn't think comparative theology is even feasible. What you do with that, or what your opinion is on it.
Yeah, this is religion and Orientalism, is that the name of it?
I think so. Yeah. Post-colonial something.
Okay, yeah. Good book if you haven't seen it, Richard King. He teaches here somewhere, is he?
Somewhere in England, not often.
Yeah. I mean, to some extent, you know, that's a lot of that's very true, and that's why I said you shouldn't theologize without attention to other disciplines and history and so on. But the whole kind of Orientalist critique back to Edward Said's book, Orientalism, I think he uses Ronald Inden's book, Imagining India. Mm-hmm. Inden was one of my teachers in grad school, so he persecuted me often on these things. But that, you know, the word Hinduism is not a traditional Indian term, that to start with. Sort of the expectation with Max Müller and the great books of the, you know, the East and so on, come up with a religion, a founder, a book and so on. But also the more complicated intertwining in which, like, you know, Calcutta intellectuals in the 19th century, talking to their British overlords, began to rethink and revise Hindu tradition so as to fit into these Western academic modes. I think all of that is true. But I don't think that everything is just a construction. I mean, I think there are, first of all, in the Indian tradition, other persistent ways of talking about religious realities that weren't co-opted by the West. I think there are also changes that are even right now happening. And I think that if one goes beyond generalities, you do in fact locate particular others who are not simply products of the Western academics. So right now I'm reading a text, the Soundarya Lahari, a medieval goddess text, with seven traditional commentaries on it. And while maybe printing it as a book with some kind of an Orientalist production or something, people did write these commentaries, and they used to be on palm leaves. And there's a whole kind of presentation of text and commentary, which I think is larger than Western constructions of India. I also don't think anything is so other that one finds it impenetrable or inaccessible, because if something was really totally other, you'd have absolutely nothing to say about it. But there are these interactive elements. I mean, I mentioned like some of the postmodern ambivalences and so on, that partially it is, I'm making it up as I go along. You know, I'm picking the goddess text and calling it a goddess text because I'm looking for something relevant to Christian theology. But I wouldn't go to the extreme of saying I'm just talking to myself about myself. Mm-hmm. Is that?
Yes. Because you're doing the religion, which is more than just texts, ideas, and that kind of side of things. How far do you go into being an insider, going into the traditional, the spiritual side, what it means to practice, perhaps, rather than just the ideas and talking about it?
Yeah, and that too is very important. One practical thing, I always tell people that texts are really convenient, and that there are all kinds of other interesting things, even just on the, you know, study level, that one can do, and one shouldn't imagine that all scholars should be reading books all the time, but that all kinds of work in the social sciences, work with art, music, drama, pilgrimage, ritual practice, I mean, all kinds of things that can be observed in the field and done by other methods of scholarship than by sitting down reading books. Oral traditions that never get written down. modern media. There's all this other kind of stuff that's outside of books, first of all, to begin with. Secondly, there's, as you say, in part, there's the kind of internal aspects of it. You might say the spirituality or the mystical, or the things of the other tradition that can only be learned by practicing them. And to some extent, it's a problem. It's a problem if you kind of consciously define yourself, as I do, as not being a Hindu, whatever that means. That there are ways in which, I'm a Roman Catholic, and Roman Catholics are very fussy about boundaries. And if you go to a Catholic church, they'll say you're most welcome, but if you're not a Catholic, don't come to communion. It's sort of like going to Sri Rangam, the big temple in South India, Hindus only, when you get to be certain, you know, prakara. So there are levels of kind of identity of communities that want in some ways to have boundaries. And yet a sense also that, like, I wouldn't say to somebody, you know, if you've read a lot of Thomas Aquinas, you sort of get what being a Catholic is. You do and you don't. And that the music, the worship, the life choices, family, and so on. I think two other things. One is, when I've been in India, it's been a while now, so I had a sabbatical for a year about 8 years ago. I've been back only a briefer time since then. I was working on a Sri Vaishnava tradition, the Tamil Alvar texts, and tried to go into a Hindu temple every day. Lots of temples in Madras, so you can actually do that, and hit the festivals and talk to the priests and sort of what in the Indian context is called darshan. You sort of see and be seen, which is neatly neutral in a way, because you don't have to do anything, but it can be very powerful to see and be seen. To some extent, experience. I also, the other thing I'd say is, reading text opens doors. And that you are what you read to some extent, I think. If you're reading spiritual classics or highly sophisticated texts that make you think differently, it's like, you know, you are what you eat, you are what you think. And that reading certain texts for years and years can change you. You know, I'm lecturing on the Upanishads now. I think that has to change me after a time. Even if I don't have a teacher and I'm not doing Upasana with a Vedic guru, thinking these things through and reading the text and reading the translation and talking about it has some kind of an effect on a person. But there are limits, and I think you know, Christians believe in conversion. At a certain point you can believe I should actually belong to the other and name myself as belonging to the other. Other traditions have different answers to that, whether it makes any difference whether you change over officially or not. But I think there's a whole kind of gray area where you are not the other, you are the other. And then you count your cost. You know, if I make certain choices, then I don't get certain things.
Yeah, you said that easier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I often, you know, tell my students in America, or talk to faculty even in America, about the phenomenon that many professors teaching Buddhism in American universities will introduce meditation into the classroom. And, you know, we're going to do Zen for 10 minutes at the beginning of class, or we'll go do Vipassana on the weekend or something. And it's sort of, okay, that's nice. That's good. Whereas if I was teaching Krishna, or teaching Kali, and said, you know, on Tuesday we're all going to, you know, dance and sing to Krishna, or we're going to offer a goat to Kali, you know, then you can't, it's a different kind of thing. And people think that doing yoga, doing Zen is sort of cool and, you know, it's not as challenging. But if you're engaged in singing and dancing to Krishna, or if you're offering to Kali, that seems a lot harder for people to get a hold of and to do. And yet, probably in a way, Zen is equally engaging, obviously, if you really get into it. But we tend to treat it as casual. I would just meditate for an hour. It's no big deal.
Or simply is a kind of a
I would say three things. One would be, like I have Roman numeral 2 there, we've always been doing it anyway. This is what human beings do, they're always comparing. That's the argument from history, so that's, you know, but it's also embedded in scriptures, that scriptures are comparative, and you can't read the Bible without thinking about the Egyptians and the Moabites and so on. So there's a historical level. I think also, to some extent, the theologians, as I stressed, are related to community. Theologians are supposed to be people who are thinking with and for their communities. At least in the United States, because I can't speak for other cultures or countries so easily. In the United States, a lot of Americans, church-going or not church-going, are thinking a lot about religious identity and other people's religious identities. And I think there's a role that just as traditionally a theologian in the Catholic Church might be somebody who reflects on the meaning of the Mass and the sacraments and the saints for Catholics, in today's American church at least, presumably the same here in the UK, there would be the same responsibility and possibility of thinking for and to and with the community about the experience of being of such and such a religious tradition in a multiple context, in which one has a tradition of saying, we have the right faith and you should convert to ours, and yet increasingly there's so much evidence that in fact the other is attractive and good and virtuous and highly, you know, responsible in many ways. What do we make of all that? The other thing I'd say, thirdly, is that I think there is an academic intellectual thrust. Because, and that's maybe where I started, actually. Because on one level, in college was studying philosophy, and for ordination studied theology. But I found I had all kinds of questions that didn't fit in the European Christian boundary. And that words like God, or revelation, or truth, or life after death, broke those boundaries and said, well, what do other people think about these things? And to decide for myself, I will not think about what other people think about these things, was kind of an intellectually dead end. So I found there was kind of an intellectual thrust across the boundaries. I wouldn't say that comparative theology answers all questions, and I can think of, you know, other reasons why people interact. So there are all kinds of, like, common issues that concern us as human beings, or issues of human rights or justice, I don't think are resolved by comparative theology. And people can work together for a better environment, for, you know, children's health, for women's rights, without sitting in a university. But most things we do are not solving all problems anyway. Yes?
In light of the pluralistic impulses in today's world, how are we to view the boundaries which do exist? I mean, is the goal of this effort to create a sort of meta-religion or a meta-consciousness so we all can share one, or is there a particular value to the distinctness of these different traditions that we're in?
Good question. I think there are various kind of globalizing theories that try to bring everything together. There are mystical tendencies like the philosophy of Perennis, these kind of European mystical traditions of theosophy and so on that try to kind of find the underlying common ground that all religious traditions share and bring that to the surface. Some scholars like John Hick, his work, kind of theorizing about the noumenon and the phenomena, that all religions are really partially articulate ways of talking about the reality, and that none of them, by definition, can be complete. So there's all that kind of thing that's going on. There's also kind of the neutral, objective study of religion that some people still hold to, that all we should be doing are being scholars in universities, observing religious phenomena, and weaving together a greater and greater theory of religion that is not rooted in any particular tradition. And books, people do that endlessly, write books about what is religion and what is the history of religion and so on. So all those things certainly take place. Using the term comparative theology, as I do, is partially a plea to have roots somewhere. Other people may opt not to want to do that, but I think stressing that theology is usually a communal function with a community and a base and so on. The dynamic I tend to have in my mind is you go from where you begin into conversation, you're changed by your travels to the other, and then you come back. Now I mentioned under Roman numeral 1, number 4, maybe it's something that doesn't actually fit in the boundaries anymore. If you do it enough, like if somebody travels the world all the time, maybe they can never go home again. If you're so well versed in religions other than your own, maybe you're kidding yourself to think, well, I'm just going to go to temple on Sunday or church on Sunday, just like any other pious believer.
At that point, is the value of comparison lost? This, as you say, we go through comparison, but we're not anywhere in particular in the same application. Is that a problem?
It's a problem. Well, it's a problem if it is a problem. I mean, and first of all, some people grow up without any particular roots anyway. I think I always thought of myself as growing up with a fairly defined Christian identity. But like students I teach in Boston, a lot of times their parents are kind of were exploring, and they grew up in a very vague environment, so you can't say, well, you should be part of something and you're not. But, there can be a kind of academic cynicism that creeps in. Here's one more religion, or here's one more way of saying the same thing, or here's one more text without a reference to reality, or here's one more construction. It could be a loss then if everything sort of has no reference to reality, and it's simply words about words about words, or images of things that don't exist. But I think you always have to have room for the exception. Somebody who begins somewhere, takes the other seriously, either converts to the other or finds himself or herself floating. And I wouldn't say that that's all a loss. I mean, for some people that may actually be, that's where they are, and they might as well think from that position rather than lamenting it. But it's a good question, because you have to sort out the gains and losses. A lot of, again, what I think of myself as doing is then trying to speak back to Christians, and correspondingly somebody else speak back to a Hindu community or a Buddhist or Islamic about why this is something to be done, something to be thought about. But some people reach the point where they don't have a community to speak back to. Yes?
I can see the important benefit of being compared with theology the tradition. But I'm curious as to what the comparative theology even to say the Buddhist theology that you study.
Yeah. Good question. I mentioned that at the top, being aware of it as an issue, that theology and, let's say, as I said, Sinology or Indology should not be separated, and we shouldn't see a dichotomy between the study of religion and theology as if you can do one or do the other. I think people do, like professionally, what kind of degree are you going to get? And attitudinally, they may find themselves more comfortable with one or the other. But I think partially it's a value, first of all, overlapping ground, and it's hard to sort out today. Like if somebody's writing and reading and thinking in English, there's so much overlap, and even if you're not studying religion, the study of religion impacts the way you think about religion, and then all these words are problematic. So if you talk about Hinduism or the Hindu religion or revelation or grace, or self, or death, or love. It's not really possible to say, well, these words mean exactly what I mean by my theological tradition, because a scholar of religion can problematize that and say, well, these words are used in different ways by different people. These words have a history, like I mentioned, even comparative theology has a 19th century history. And if you sort of take the words that your theological tradition has created and sort of say, these are the words that name reality, So I want the Chinese now to tell me who their god is and what their sacred book is and who their founder is and so on. It's a big mess. And I think from a theological perspective, the study of religion, and including like Richard King's book and post-Orientalist studies, raise kind of questions that keep theologians honest and maybe embarrass them when they're taking too many things for granted. Now, if you turn it around the other way, which maybe was your point, I think, again, Richard King's book is, I don't know him personally, but his work is very good, and I recommend his book that you read. But I think if one comes to the point of saying, well, all of this, like Hinduism is a construction, it's a product of the Orientalist English, French, European superimposition of India, and that really it's simply certain people thinking their own thoughts in their own minds and sort of laying it on the other for certain reasons of power and goals they seek and so on. I think the theologian can claim at least that all of these things have much more of a real life basis, that there is such a thing as human experience, there is such a thing as reality, there is such a thing as efficacious spiritual paths, there is truth. There is actually, there truly are others who are not the product of my imagination. They are really different from me, but they're not so alien that I can't get to know them. So I think, you know, to balance somehow, not all students, scholars of religion are, you know, subaltern and post-Orientalists, but to some extent to take the study of religion and put it back into the context of the way people live their lives religiously is important. Which is sort of maybe what Joe was implying in part, that if you just end up being an academic talking to other academics academically about what people may or may not actually believe, you end up in a smaller world, and there has to be some kind of real life way, and I think theology can help scholars of religion to remember that real world, and people who are not theologians can help theologians to remember the wider world and so on. Also, I mean, I find the history of religions often also can be biased. That, like a lot of the work on Orientalism in Said and King and Indon, basically ignores the Catholic missionary tradition, or plays it only lip service. That it's as if the British invented India, whereas two centuries before the British did anything significant with India, there were already Jesuits translating Sanskrit texts and learning Tamil and so on. And now, great, it didn't change the world, so I mean, there's a point in which it didn't shape European thinking. But there are other strands of thought that are more theological that may get lost in a study of religion approach, that you dismiss them because they're all just missionaries and they don't pay attention to that. Yes.
Could you say a little bit about the different epistemological foundations between study of religion and study of theology? Or is it necessary to have a different, to be a comparative theologian, have a different understanding of truth or knowledge?
I think there's some kind of it's kind of an analogy or an analogous relationship in which there are similarities and differences. I mentioned, Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages claiming that theology was a science. Now, he said the object and source of every science has its topic, and the topic of theology is God, so it's not exactly like physics or something. But he wanted to have it as a university discipline where it was open to argument, critique, scholarly exchange, and so on. And I think I'm sort of that view to a large extent, that if theology becomes kind of a world of esoteric knowledge that is so privileged that nobody outside can ever either understand it or criticize it, that would be a great loss to theology, which would cease to be interesting to outsiders or even insiders maybe. And then one of the ways the connection would be signaled would be by arguing that the study of religion and theology would share some criteria. I mean, just in terms of ways of knowing, sources of knowledge. A lot of this is argued out, like in the Indian context, let's say with the Pramana theory, the theory of ways of knowing, and traditionally, you know, there's pratyaksha or perception, anumana or inference, and vakya or shabda, word, as the first three. And it's, there are all these kind of arguments in medieval India about whether perception, whether all knowledge is perception. And then the arguments know that it's not, because there's often secondary thinking which gives you true knowledge which would not be known otherwise by logic or inference. And that goes beyond perception. And that there's also testimony or word, religiously or non-religiously, in which you learn things that you would never learn by perception or thinking. In a way, you could position theology as a discipline that holds on to that third pramana, that there is some kind of privileged tradition, some kind of a source of knowledge that is experiential and is rational, but not just experiential and not just rational, and that there's some kind of other third source of learning. But you can have, you can have classical epistemologies for the study of religion and classical epistemologies for theology. So there's a real world, there's a definite truth, and so on. You can have modern scientific modes in each one. You can have postmodern uncertainties. And I think to a lot of extent there's going to be resemblances of the way certain people study religion and the way certain people study theology. And sometimes the dichotomy comes when you get a really classicist theologian talking to a postmodern scholar of religion. It isn't so much theologian, scholar of religion, it's just that a postmodern person and a classical person. Whereas you might get, a mid-20th century scholar of religion and, let's say, fairly liberal academic theologian who could understand each other perfectly and they just sort of agree. But at some level, theology claims to have some kind of privileged knowledge, which at least has a source which is not simply human experience. I don't know, but that's an important question to push, I think, because
it's where theologians need to be insiders. It's almost like the study of religion, you're supposed to be an outsider, you're not supposed to bring the view of
religion.
My
definition, comparative theology is both appealing to the insider discourse and claiming that outsiders can get somewhere in their learning of discourses to which they're outside. So that one, clearly if you accept theology at all, you can say you can be theological in your own tradition. Okay. One could say at the boundary of that, when you step out of your tradition, all you can be is a scholar of religion, because that the other is not yours and you haven't practiced it, you don't believe it, and so on. But I think there, it's not so black and white, that there, when you cross over to the other, you can be understanding and not understanding, practicing, not practicing, believing, not believing, in a way that the theologians do anyway, because, like, again, in Christian theology, Roman Catholics are always reading Lutheran texts and Anglican texts and Orthodox texts and reading Jewish texts and so on, and claim, oh, sure, all this is possible. Why it suddenly becomes impossible when one goes further afield would be improbable, I think.